Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
Welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet online and on KBIA. I'm Ryan Femuelner. Ruben Stern is on vacation this week. It's no secret that being a parent is a tough job, but with the advent of social networks and new mobile technology, it could at times feel overwhelming. With the ubiquity of tablet PCs and smartphones, children are more connected than ever. But it brings with it a set of new problems. How do parents monitor their kids' online behavior without being intrusive? How do you best use technology in the home, and how do you impose limitations without being overbearing? Joining me on today's show are a panel of experts that could help us begin to answer these and other questions. Jen Reeves is an associate professor at the Missouri School of Journalism. She also runs the blog Born Just Right, which follows her own experience as a mother. Jen, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks.
Brad Anderson, let me make sure and get his title right. He's with the State 4-H Youth Development Specialist. He acts as a mentor to young people involved with the organization. He's also a father of a 3-year-old daughter. Brad, thanks for being here.
I'm glad to be here.
And Meg Ladd is Program Manager for ParentLink. The organization supports Missouri families by connecting parents with information and resources like a free telephone helpline. Mm-hmm. Welcome, Meg.
Thank you.
And finally, Scott Steinberg is a nationally recognized expert on parenting in the digital age. He's the author of the Modern Parents Guidebook series and himself is a father. Scott's joining us by the phone. Thanks for talking to us, Scott.
Cheers. My pleasure. Thanks.
All right. And we hope to hear from you in the audience as well. For the parents in our audience, what concerns do you have about raising kids in the digital age? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925. Email us at intersection@kbia.org, or you can join our online chat. Okay, so to get us started here, again, these are technology, it's advancing so quickly. I mean, even there's a difference between months ago, but in the past 5 years or so, just to put a time frame on it, how has being a parent changed in the last 5 years? What are some of the new, I guess, concerns parents have in the last 5 years?
I think in so many ways, there's some of the same age-old concerns. That it comes down to the same basic issues, but there's just so many other ways to express these issues now than there wasn't when we were children.
And I also think that they are documented more than, the conflicts and the good and the bad. It's so much easier archived and remembered. So even the littlest things can easily become bigger or better or worse. You know?
Right. Well, yeah, and they never go away, of course.
They never really go away, yeah.
And we have to keep in mind that as little as 5-6 years ago, when we talked about friend, it actually referred to people that you knew in real life.
Yeah, that's true.
Crazy talk.
Hundreds of folks online, and like we were talking about, the perpetuity of content that lives online forever, and most, even at 2 years old, they're saying over 80% of toddlers now have a digital footprint.
Mm-hmm. Right, so what are the concerns with that, I guess? The fact that your child... Maybe not even they definitely can't probably grasp the ramifications of being online at that time and the fact that nothing goes away. They don't realize that when they're 70, this might be something that matters, what went on when they're 2, right? But what are some of the ramifications? What are some of the concerns, I guess, you can have for your child in that regard?
I think that's one of the things we're finding. Look at Generation Y, who were born probably late 80s, early 90s, and they're starting to get to college age right now. And one of their characteristics was... or is that they tended to own what they put out there. They knew that it was online forever, but they tended not to worry about being ashamed of something or concerned about, should I post this, should I not? They just owned it. Now they're getting closer to the working world, and in some cases in the working world. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Yeah, well, I have an interesting perspective because I work with college students, and I have children who have been documented from before they were born. And, you know, I speak with college students and I explain to them why they feel very comfortable speaking in the digital world. So comfortable, they don't always think about the ramifications. They're so open, and I have to remind them, I saw that. My children are being raised knowing that it's out there, and they are very documented. They're also already aware of that. And that's I'm not going to say it's bad because that's life now. And so I'm teaching them about literacy at a very young age. That's something that I think my college students could use.
Well, and I guess also just teaching your child to be a good citizen online, too, I guess. Well, how does that factor in? Well, I mean, there's not really any principles out there, right? It's more, or are there? Brad?
Well, I'm actually looking at Jen. Missouri Kids First has a terrific program called Digital Citizenship. There's a little card that youth have, and I wish I had it memorized right now. But one of the things is part of it's about being a digital citizen is saying, you know, I will protect my identity online. I will be thoughtful of what I post. And I'll be aware of the feelings of others and things like that. So there are ways you can be a digital citizen in a cyber age.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I think at ParentLink we get a lot of calls about when is too soon to introduce your children to cell phones or to have a Facebook page. And definitely it's individual depending on the parent and the child and what they're comfortable with. But setting those boundaries is what we, you know, way up front set the boundaries and be open about it. That's what we usually advice.
And let's be honest about what's changed here, too. Is, you know, some of the basic parenting principles still apply, but I think what a lot of people miss is that homework and these learnings, these teachings, they're not just for kids. They're actually for parents as well, right? So at the end of the day, we have to be having these conversations, and it's a moving target, right? So even if you prepare them, even if you teach them digital citizenship basics, the rules are changing week in and week out as new products and services and ways to connect and communicate are introduced. So it's a running commitment from parents as well.
That's true, and there's often a fear of not being a part of it. I know many parents who just teach their kids fear. I'd rather that we teach our kids understanding and literacy instead of fear. I actually work with a lot of freshmen who come to college where their families are like, don't go and don't blog and don't touch Facebook. And it's actually a part of professional world now. And so if you come in with the fear, then you're not going to build a positive and, you know, an understanding of how to use it well.
Well, yeah, because it's such an integral part of regular society at this point, right?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, to just say I'm going to block, you know, willy-nilly, I'm just going to block everything. I mean, it's going to be much more difficult later on for them to catch up, right?
Yeah.
So what are some of the – you were talking about boundaries as well, Meg. What are some of those boundaries, I guess, that you have to think about as a parent?
Definitely scheduling time to not have your cell phone on you or any electronics. I think that that's important to plan outings as a family for a couple hours at a time, just to get away from it, but still not to feel bad if you do enjoy it. Like, you know, I think there is an outlet there for kids. There's, you know, productive games that are educational. Like, we have to see the good too and not just be afraid of what they could see or...
Yeah, I had an interesting experience a few years ago. My aunt was very sick, and she used Webkinz as a way to connect with her grandchildren, and my son got one, and she was like, oh, well, let's do this together. And she sent him food for his animal, and I was like, oh, whatever. Well, he talked to her on the phone a few weeks later, and then he was like, why didn't you send me any more food? And she goes, well, you never said thank you.
Oh,
and,
wow.
Right.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, look at this. We're learning online manners through a little kid game. And now I actually really encourage him to try these. They're very set. You can only say certain words to each other, and they're usually polite words. Mm-hmm. And if you want to be a partner with somebody on a game, if you're polite to them, they're going to work with you better. And so there's some actual very simple ways at a pretty young age to learn that you should be respectful in person and online. And I thought that was a neat little moment where I'm like, oh, I shouldn't fight these. We should take advantage of these moments, the little teachable moments, even in these little innocuous-looking games.
Yeah, and I think it's sort of the thing that many people miss is technology can be hugely positive and beneficial, and it's so interactive, and there's so many opportunities to teach kids about different perspectives and what's going on out there in these virtual worlds. And even the simplest exercises, there are very educational lessons, and the best part about it is a lot of them can actually encourage lifelong learning.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. I'm going to take one quick second to remind our listeners that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Femuhlener, filling in for Reuben Stern. Being a parent can be difficult enough, but with the advent of social media and new technology, it can at times feel overwhelming. On this week's Intersection, we're talking about parenting in the digital age. Our guests in the studio today are Jen Reeves, a mother of two who runs the blog Born Just Right, following her experience as a mother. Brad Anderson is a state 4-H youth development specialist and acts as a mentor to young people involved with the organization. Meg Ladd is a program manager for ParentLink, which helps Missouri families by connecting parents with information and resources. And Scott Steinberg is joining us by the phone. He's the author of the Modern Parents Guidebook series. And for you and our audience, how do you think parenting has changed in recent years? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection at kbia.org. We'd like to remind you that Intersections presented as streaming video during our live conversations every Monday afternoon at 2 online at kbia.org. You can watch the video and join our online chat by going to kbia.org and scrolling down to the link for Intersection. Again, that's Mondays at 2 online at kbia.org. So yeah, we've talked a lot about, like you said, bridging that gap between the real world and your online life, I guess. So maybe is it smart though to put limits time wise maybe on your day? That screen time, I guess I've heard it called, the time that your kids are spending in front of these devices or just in front of the regular old TV. What kind of limits? I don't know if there's a standard or it kind of depends on the age, I suppose too.
Well, some of the parents of younger teens that I've asked about this have told me that they have limits set in terms of when the child can be on the computer. And especially one of a 13-year-old has said she's not allowed to be on the computer when we're not there. When we log into Facebook, it's a password that we've set, and we type it in for her. And then the Facebook time is there, but it's also known that the parents can get on, check anything out whenever they want. And just like in the offline world, I think most parents, when the teenager is going to a party or an event, they'll say, well, who are you going to be with? Who's going to be there? Mm-hmm. And what will you be doing? And I think that that's probably true of the online world as well.
But then you're also getting in that territory of maybe tracking a little bit or trying to keep tabs on your child. And I guess there's a lot of more opportunities for that, right, in the digital world now as parents. What about that? What about that mentality of how much is too much on keeping track of your child, I guess?
One thing I've heard is that it's amazing how easy that is. Some of the advice I've read in various sources, and it'll be interesting to see what Scott says about this, the advice is to have big eyes and big ears and a small mouth. And if you lay low, it's just amazing what you'll find out, because out of sight, out of mind. And if you're worried about your child or if you just want to keep track of what's going on, sometimes silence is the best opportunity.
Yeah, and I agree to some extent. I actually think if you're going to monitor kids, you really should let them know about it. There's a real trust issue there, and they don't want to think that they're being spied on, but they do need to know that they are being observed, and they need to maintain proper standards of conduct and behavior. And I think it's important to note as well is that any determined tot, right? Back in the day, I was a teenage male once upon a time, and any determined tot is going to circumvent these safeguards. They can go over to friends' houses. They can get themselves a Gmail account. So really the best thing that we can do is encourage them to come forward with open and honest discussion, educate them, prepare them, teach them healthy computing habits, know that they're going to encounter questionable situations. But at the end of the day, we need to enable them, right, to make healthy, positive decisions and know that they are going to stumble across it. But we should also maintain a presence. Often say if you're going to be in the social networking sites, if you're going to be on Facebook and friends with your kid, not a big deal, but don't go posting on their wall, right?
We all have that uncle or aunt that we adored as a child, and we might have loved to have spent time with them, but we still didn't invite them on dates with us, and we didn't invite them when we went to hang out with our friends, and I think that's probably true with social media as well.
Well, if you don't mind me asking, bridging that gap between you guys being experts and you're all parents too, are you all transparent with your kids, or how have you had to think about that yet, or how are you going to approach that subject, I guess?
Yeah, I think I try to be for the most part. Like I said earlier, my 3-year-old, he loves to flip through photos on my phone, and I think he's looking at previous weekends or things that we've done, activities we've done together. So he's allowed my phone for that. We Skype now. I have relatives who are out of town, and so we're able to share in that together.
I have a really fascinating experience where I've had a blog that I launched before my daughter was born, but when she was born with one hand, it became a very different perspective. And I have openly discussed the process of becoming a parent of special needs and becoming the advocate that I am for her and now for not just the limb difference world, but I'm focused on helping advocate for special needs as a whole. And so because of that, my daughter and son have met many, many people just through the blog. We have actual meetups when we go out of town. My daughter knows that when we do something cool, she would like put that on the Born Just Right Facebook page. She doesn't care if people like it or anything. Unless somebody gives her extra tips or advice, I'll share that with her. We talked to a woman who plays, she's a musician who plays with a little helper arm. She has a little arm as well. And she plays the guitar. And my daughter was like, I want to play the guitar. And I told her that on Twitter. And the artist was like, awesome, she should do that. And Jordan was so excited that I talked to a musician. Mm-hmm. So my kids have a very different experience because they see I'm going through social media for very positive reasons. We're mm-hmm. trying to help and inform and do good. We raised $2,300 for a summer camp in honor of Jordan's birthday in December of last year. You know, she is seeing the power. Both kids are seeing the power of how we're building community and friendships mm-hmm. that way, in ways that they think it's totally normal to find people with limb differences. We meet kids all the time that have never met another kid in person, and to my kids, that's so normal. And so we're very transparent, and we're also very in it.
Right, but that that's a great example of for a parent. I mean, it's been such a great asset not only for you but for other parents that have stumbled upon your blog, correct?
Right?
I mean, and that has to be, I mean, it's kind of like the same thing you guys are trying to do, both of you, I guess, in your organizations, Brad and Meg. So, I mean, can the digital age also be a benefit in that way to parents? I mean, to have those answers readily available that maybe weren't 20 years ago.
Oh, absolutely. And it's such a draw developmentally. My child is 3 years old, so everything she says is transparent, and she likes to share everything. And I hope that continues through life. I think as I've talked to parents of teens in 4-H, the parents have told me that they feel if your child has a Facebook account, you should have a Facebook account too. This should not be a foreign language when you're talking about something that's so important to the life of your teen, or, well, hopefully your teen. We had a 294 11 to 13-year-olds this weekend in Missouri here in Columbia for our State 4-H Teen Conference. And just as an afterthought on the survey at the end, I put a question, are you using social media? 22% of them said yes, 11 to 13 years old.
Wow.
And most of them indicated Facebook. Some indicated Twitter, Flickr, and a few others. But Facebook was obviously the most common.
Yeah.
And I guess that, like you said, that literacy among parents as well. I mean, because, how else can you know what your child is doing and maybe help them make the right decisions without really being capable, I guess. And it's tough because there's a generation gap. And again, these things change so fast. Even the different social media sites, you know, there's a lot to keep up with, I'm sure.
Yeah, but I think a lot of parents miss it. It's not that hard, right? Even us experts can't do it. It's a lot, very head-spinning many times. But most of the answers are a Google search away, right? There's other parents out there dealing with this. There's other publications and outlets, all of which, you know, Facebook even provides all sorts of great safety tips. So the nice part is there's so many ways to connect and communicate. And at the end of the day, I think a lot of parents, when it comes to fear and technology, it really helps to get over that because they're missing the fact that it's hard to know what to combat if you don't know what you're up against. And on top of it, great bonding opportunity, great way to bridge the gap between generations.
Right.
I'm going to remind our listeners one more time that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuliner, filling in for Reuben Stern. On this week's Intersection, we're talking about parenting in the digital age. With the advent of social media and new technology, can feel at times overwhelming. Here in our studio, we have Jen Reeves, who is a professor at Missouri Journalism School, and she runs the blog Born Just Right, following her experiences as a mother. Brad Anderson is a State 4-H Youth Development Specialist and acts as a mentor to young people involved with the organization. And Meg Ladd is Program Manager for ParentLink, which helps Missouri families by connecting parents with information and resources. Scott Steinberg is joining us by the phone. He's the author of the Modern Parents Guidebook Series. And for you our audience, do you limit your kids' screen time? What are the rules that have been effective for you in your home? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. Kind of getting back to that, setting these rules, how important is that? And I've also heard maybe incentivizing you can earn that time if you go play outside for a few hours, or you go, or you take out the trash, or how important is it to still encourage other activity? Because again, I mean, I'm sure that we as adults find ourselves being tied to these devices a lot. It's so much easier for a child, right?
Right. Well, I think the answer is it's not important. It's essential, right? It's vital. It's part of everyday life, and technology has to be part of a healthy diet. You got to get outside, got to do other activities. American Academy of Pediatrics says no more than about 30 minutes to an hour of screen time every day. Obviously, some families, that's going to differ. I think incentivizing it, almost making a game of it where kids can earn time or time is subtracted based on behavior is actually a great approach to it.
I'm feeling a little guilty because right now my kids are playing on iPads while I speak here.
Well, other parents out there appreciate it.
I think it's a great tool for time management. Mm-hmm. You know, here are the things you have to get done in your day, and you know, if you can feed the cats and get dressed and take care of these things, then absolutely you can have some screen time.
Mm-hmm. There's some research I came across some time ago, and I wish I could remember the source, but they looked at just the research review, and they had the two variables of warmth and control, and they looked at families who had high warmth, low warmth, high control, low control, and then, of course, you can imagine the little four-square box that you can do with that. They found that the best youth outcomes came when there was high warmth and high control, mm-hmm. but interestingly, the second most positive outcomes came from the group where there was high warmth and low control, and I think I was thinking low warmth and high control would have better child outcomes. So that, to me, that said, the warmth is the most important thing. If you have that relationship there, whether it's online or offline, there's just so much you can do and accomplish.
Right, right. So, again, talking about we as adults, is it also difficult though to find ourselves being distracted when we're with our kids? I've read multiple, but when, I mean, giving our kids the time they need when we ourselves are distracted by these devices. You know, I've read stories about people, you know, at the grocery store, and or I've seen this happen as well. You know, their kids are tugging at them, you know, and saying, "Hey, I need your attention," and you're sending an email or you're texting or something. How does that factor in on the adult side? I guess you're creating a standard, right?
Right. Right.
Well, we have to set down times, and actually we've instituted here what we call the Bad Daddy program, where my daughter can actually shriek down the stairs at Dad is working from the office, and it's time to come up for dinner. I mean, really, we need to have set times, whether it's during meals or family time, where we put down the BlackBerry, the iPhone, and say, sorry, not going to do this, and understand that we have to set limits. But practically, I mean, yes, it's getting harder and harder, right, because work-life balance, not a fundamentally new problem, but it's been way out of whack now, right? The scales are leaning one way. And at the end of the day, I mean, I think it's important to also remind parents, you don't have to feel guilty, right? If you need the kid to look at the iPad or the iPhone so you can get 20 minutes of peace at dinner once in a while, it's okay.
I think it's been a wonderful thing and a challenging thing for me because my daughter was born 6 years ago, and when she was born 6 years ago, I just changed into an interactive position in my newsroom, and so I have been able to be very focused on the care that she needs and the activities that my children go to. And I know my son complained once about a year ago. He's like, "You're on your phone." I'm like, "And you're at piano lessons. So be glad I can take you to piano lessons." And it's because my job is portable like this. But we do have a rule of no phones, no technology at dinner. And I block out an hour to 2 hours of bedtime that is technology free. And the newsroom is aware of that. And my, you know, anyone that tries to reach me, they're not going to hear from me. I also run, and I do a no technology run. I don't do songs. I don't. I might track my miles, but I don't do anything else. It's just my quiet time, and it shows my kids that I think physical exercise is very important and mm-hmm. great mm-hmm. for the brain.
And Brad, what about you? Have you heard any of that from? I know you said you've talked to some families in your guys' program as well. Have you heard about that? The other side of it for parents struggling with this, I guess.
Well, I know we struggle with it because I married a fellow tech enthusiast, and if we let ourselves, we could easily be drawn into her, you know, iPod and my Droid, and mm-hmm. there's our child sitting there. And fortunately, we have a child that doesn't allow for that, so she's quick to say, "Pay attention to me." But I think that'll carry through as she gets older as well. And I love the idea of. Some limitations on your time for social media, technology. You need to have a balance in life.
And I think kids can assist with this too, right? Yeah. As you were pointing out, our children can actually tell us when to get off. So we need to have house rules that everybody agrees to, and I think it's important for kids to know that mom and dad are going to abide by them as well.
Yes.
Well, and I guess how is, you know, it's kind of getting back to the idea of the kids now, but how is their development going to be related to their interaction with social media and just the way that they have built these online personas and interact with you? How is their actual development going to be affected? Or, again, there's not a whole lot of studies on this because this is a new phenomenon, but how much do you have to think about that? And what are some of the techniques, I guess, that you can use to try to prepare for that, I guess?
My favorite definition of social media is it's just technology used to connect people with others. And so one thing I've really been impressed with in working with teens is that they don't see this online world and the offline world as being so separate.
Right.
They won't say anything to you online that they won't come up and talk to you offline, and they'll continue the conversation in person that they started online. I think people in my generation maybe didn't do that so much. It was such a new thing. So for me, it's really just about communication. I work with a group of 36 teens on our State 4-H Council, and they help to plan activities, weigh in on policy issues for our organization, and they do a lot of great work as teens for 4-H. And when I took the position, they had met, I think, four times a year in person, and there was mailings that went out via snail mail, and they came back, and they'd mail in whether they could be at the meeting or not. And so one of them showed me Facebook, and all of a sudden, hey, Facebook, we're all on Facebook. And so since mm-hmm. that's where they were, that's where I went, and now we just meet year-round, and we accomplish so much more. Bottom line, though, it's still communication.
Right, that's a great point. At Parent Link, we supervise a lot of interns and students, and we always email. That's the culture of our office, and students do not email. They will get back to you a week later. And so we had to learn, you know, you text to communicate, mm-hmm. and again, reaching them where they're at. I think that's a good point.
And so much of what I've heard from parents is that all of this comes down to trust and open communication with your child. And if you know that doesn't happen overnight. If you've built trust and communication over time, that's going to be there in the social media world and everything else. So much as they get to be teenagers and they become so busy and you're not getting as much FaceTime as you used to because their friends are now more important to them, it's interesting because some tell me that texting is really one way that they keep the lines of communication open.
Right, right. And it's gotten to be a very common mode of communication for teens, right? Texting. I mean, it's kind of, I've seen studies that it's gotten to be more than any other single mode of communication, it's text now, right?
Yeah, and the study I see is that I think it was 66% of it's the most popular use of mobile phones right now, followed by photographs. But texting is the number one most used. I actually have one teenager who I worked with a couple years ago who didn't have the phone service connected on his phone. He had the cell phone so that he could do Facebook via text.
Oh, wow.
Well, and I guess, I don't know if you guys have had this at all, but some kids will also be using these at school, right? And I've seen that that's become a problem in some school districts. They've had to, you know, put a complete ban on phones in school, that type of thing. How do you approach that with your kids as well? I mean, again, a lot of you have young kids, but that's still another issue, right? Making sure you're doing the right thing at school.
I think that the more schools ban technology, the more these kids are going to not know how to use them properly. And I think that I'm going to go out on a limb here, but I really believe that instead of ignoring the technology, we blend it into the way we teach our students. That's what I do with my college course. I expect them to follow a hashtag and tweet throughout class. It's like a live note taker, and it means they're paying attention. And if they get off track, I know it because they used it on a hashtag. I'm like, hey, stop talking about her outfit. Let's get back to what we were talking about.
And why wouldn't we use it, right?
Right.
It's much more engaging and much more interesting than the standard lecture presentation format. They're not falling asleep. They're actively involved. They're able to experiment. And many times they're working in real time. I actually speak with educators who say that technology is the future of education, especially as relates to simulated environments, because you can approach things from different angles. You're not afraid to try new things and fall on your face. You can actually see how others are doing it. You can experiment with new strategies. You're problem solving in real time. And ultimately, I think it's fantastic, but it's very worrying when you start to see things like the National Cybersecurity Alliance who are coming out and saying, for example, that teachers are unprepared to teach technology in schools. And that strikes me as, hey, you know, we probably should have been doing that since yesterday.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Well, the article I've read recently was talking about a teacher who actually uses text messaging in his high school, and the teacher's experience was that the youth who were less likely to speak up in class, maybe they were shy for whatever reason, they were just as likely to interact via text as anybody else.
Yeah.
And so on the college side, I have student workers who talked about their journalism professor.
I'm sorry, Brett. I'm going to have to interrupt you real quick because we do have to take a quick break. Our minor listeners, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. We'll be right back here after a short break. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famulin, or filling in for Reuben Stern. Being a parent can be difficult enough, but with the advent of social media and new technology, it can be at times overwhelming. On this week's Intersection, we're talking about parenting in the digital age. Our guests in the studio today are Jen Reeves, a mother of two who runs the blog Born Just Right, following her experience as a mother. Brad Anderson is a State 4-H Youth Development Specialist. He acts as a mentor to young people involved with that organization. Meg Ladd is Program Manager for Parent Link, which helps Missouri families by connecting parents with information and resources. Scott Steinberg is joining us by the phone. He's the author of the Modern Parents Guide book series. For you and our audience, how do you monitor your child's online behavior without being intrusive? Share your experience. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. And Brad, I had to interrupt you there at the break, so I'll let you finish that thought on technology in the schools, I guess.
Just, I had a student worker who was telling me it with a lot of enthusiasm about this college professor he has who uses Twitter in the classroom, and I was thinking in the back of my head, I knew that was you, Jen. So when he mentioned that, I thought, okay, I'm going to be talking to her today.
But I think I have seen, working here on the Missouri campus, I have seen a number of, not even journalism purely, but I've seen other programs as well that's become more common, that having to tweet for class or having to create a blog. I've seen that in, I want to say, the theater department. I know they do that as well. It's gotten to be, again, it's a bigger part of not just media, right? It's a bigger part of the real world.
Absolutely.
Right.
I agree.
Well, tell you what, we have a phone call. Nancy is on the line. Nancy, are you there? Nancy, are you still there? It sounds like we may have lost Nancy. We'll try to come back to her here in just a minute. But very quickly, what she's going to get at is cell phones. We can kind of start the conversation and bring her in when we have her. But yeah, one thing I was wondering about already is that what age is right, right? There's probably no set answer, and there's a lot to think about there, right? But what age? When do you start having, and then that gives them the opportunity, right, to have a cell phone in school, to bring on all these other concerns, I guess. But what kind of ages are you seeing people allowing their students to have cell phones? What do you guys think, I guess, as parents and experts?
Well, I worked with the Army Project before. I was kind of on loan before coming back to work in Missouri 4-H. And one thing, it changed my attitude towards cell phones used by children. Because if mom or dad is deployed in Afghanistan or Iraq, they need to talk to their child now when they have that opportunity. Those opportunities don't come around very often. And so when we would have youth events, those children needed to have their cell phone on at all times, and we grew to understand that. In terms of civilian life, and now I think that parents just expect to be able to reach their child whenever they need them, and sometimes that's just a comfort level.
I think it depends on the situation. You know, does your child ride the bus home and there's a 10-minute gap before you get there so that they might need a phone to text you? A lot of people don't have landlines anymore.
Yeah, that's at my house. Mm-hmm. We got rid of the landlines, and I'm very lucky. I live in a neighborhood where we walk to school every day. Mm-hmm. My son's friends are all walking or biking distance in the same, you know, neighborhood. I've made the choice that he wants to call a friend. He can call from my phone, or he can just bike over to their house. Mm-hmm. Old school. that might change when we go to middle school.
And I wouldn't say there's a hard and fast rule here, but what we do seem to see, though, is when they hit about 12, 13, I mean, realistically, you know, the easy answer, or I should say the cop-out, would be to say when your child is ready for it. They're mature and developmentally ready, but ultimately, what it seems to be is when your child is going to be out of touch, when they're going to be in a scenario where you really need to know where they are, that's the best time to put it in their hands. But again, when you're giving them a cell phone, keep in mind, you don't have to give them a smartphone that's got all the whiz-bang features, right? Mm-hmm. You can also get them prepaid plans and phones so you can keep up with progress and monitor who they're calling. So it doesn't necessarily have to be a wild west. I think where we run into trouble is where kids are walking around with iPhones that can do virtually everything.
Actually, we have Nancy back on the line now. Nancy, are you there?
Hi, I am.
Hi, Nancy.
About that earlier.
Oh no, that's okay. Well, hopefully, we already didn't cover all of your question, but what do you want to talk about today?
Well, I'm an elementary teacher, and well, I'm a mom and a grandma too. But I've been teaching upper elementary for many, many years, and I realize that the kids are bringing cell phones to school. You know, for years now, they've been bringing cell phones. And they're not really encouraged to do that at the elementary level. But I know that parents do need to communicate with their kids. So my in the classroom, my policy was, I understand you have to bring a cell phone, but I'm going to ask you to either turn it off or turn it on vibrate and put it in your backpack and leave it there. And, you know, for the most part, kids always, you know, obeyed that. But what I learned as talking with them over the years is that many of them did not understand about etiquette. They didn't understand that there are times and places that you do talk on your cell phone, you know, that's appropriate. And that there are times, for instance, a movie theater or some place like that, where you don't talk on the cell phone. And that there are volume levels for you to be aware of when you're on the cell phone. I wanted to put that out there for parents to think about, you know, to also talk with their kids about appropriate ways to use their phone.
Yeah, and Nancy, sounds like you had to take that into your hands a little bit. What do you all think about that? Is that just another part of preparing your child for this digital world, I guess?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And part of the rudeness, I think, is probably because they don't know how to operate their cell phone. So part of, and I'm very guilty of that, but so part of that responsibility of having a cell phone, I think, would be to learn how to turn it off, to learn how to move it to vibrate, to block certain features if you need to, or have apps that you need. So
I think it's another example of, these are things that your school could be teaching. Mm-hmm. I know I've spoken to some middle school folks, teachers, who say, well, I'd like to speak and teach about etiquette and social, but they're not supposed to use it until they're 13. And in many cases, families allow their children to use it before 13. And so they've already built bad habits, mm-hmm. and that they can't officially teach properly until... So it, which is a really big concern, that kids are already building a brand that's an inappropriate or an unlearned way of using social, because the parents don't know how, and the teachers who might know how don't feel like they can teach it. And I think cell phones fall under a similar route. We don't really know. We don't really have an official. Well, actually, we might have an official. There are books, but no, how many parents are reading those books?
Right.
I had to smile when Nancy was making her comments, because I've seen so much of this also applies to many adults.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the funeral is not the place to take a cell phone call.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for your call, Nancy. We appreciate it. And then we do have a comment kind of on this same note from the chat room from a guy, Professor Myers, how he identifies himself. He's talking about texting, and he's saying that at some point students start to lose their social skills as well, kids do. He says many of his grade students are also college coaches and have a hard time communicating face-to-face with students. If they have to talk to them in an email or text, they have no problems, but they have poor conversational and social skills. How do you find that balance, talking about social skills being worsened by these online interactions versus it being one of those very mainstream uses, forms of communication that kids are using now?
I've been encouraging my kids, we are finding ways to have face-to-face meetings and not just social meetings. Mm-hmm. That's something I, as a journalist, am striving for on a regular basis. I feel like to be good at social, you need to be good at the in-person, and that takes a lot of extra energy. I mean, it's so easy to connect with thousands and thousands of people online, but making sure there's some face-to-face time is worth just as much effort.
That different definition of what a friend is, right?
Yeah,
absolutely.
And then another comment we had, we'll knock a few of these off, but this was a kind of a different topic, but saying that a bigger problem than kids sharing too much online sometimes is parents sharing too much online. What do you guys think about that? I mean, I guess Jen, you know, has someone who has been blogging about their kids before they're born, as you said.
Yeah.
What do you think about that? And what are some of the things you have to think about in that regard?
Thank you for bringing that up. I mean, that's one of my big concerns, actually, I think back to when we were teenagers and people wanted to find out about kids and families and identity theft and all that stuff. And they used to have to go diving in people's trash. And now suddenly everything you want to know about your family is out there. And I think what a lot of parents need to know is, if you're going to put the information out there on Facebook, you really need to tightly control it, right? You need to set privacy settings so it's not going out to strangers. You need to keep in mind what your kid may or may not want to share. And the same holds for children as well, right? At the end of the day, we need to draw clear lines between personal and private. And of course, you know, communication can get so screwy online, where you read something in an email or in a status update and it doesn't come across the way the person intended. And it's just, you know, we need, it goes back to teaching not only etiquette, but also citizenship in schools, right, from the earliest age, and making sure that we have these conversations with kids, because if we're not monitoring the problem and there's an entirely new rules of behavior that are out there, we have to be aware that kids are going to be picking up on cues from somebody. And if it's not us, I shudder to think who's setting the example.
Well, in youth development, we think about, you know, the changes happening with their social, emotional, cognitive, and physical domains. And think about what's happening with your child socially and emotionally just as they enter their teenage years. I mean, they're more dependent on the opinions of their friends. They want to be liked. They want to be part of a group. They're very self-conscious. They're vulnerable to low self-esteem. They may have mood swings. It's very, very common to feel inadequate. So one of the best advice from parents that I've talked to is, never, never say anything or post anything that you wouldn't also say to them in front of their friends in person. Don't embarrass your child.
Yeah, I mean, I blogged about my son and my daughter's potty training, and and that could come back and bite them. And you know, I think back to Jeremy Lin. He's probably one of the most recently famous who has his childhood on MySpace, or mm-hmm. you know, those different spaces where you could see him with his pictures that he took of himself, and he looked like a goofy teenager, like we all look as a goofy teenager. And it does show how easy it is, and it should make us all think about, you know, when we look back, and, you know, my kids are searchable. You have to dig a little, but it's not that hard to connect my name to their sites. And the Born Just Right site, I'm very open about who I am and who we are and why we do what we do.
But you said you did have to make a decision at one point.
I did. And in 2010, I'd been getting more notes from families around the world thanking me for the support that they're getting by hearing my stories and learning the advocacy routes that I'm taking for my kids. And I decided to openly say, hi, I'm the person writing this, because I realized that transparency will help more parents understand I'm really a person mm-hmm. who wants to help. And I made the choice to talk more openly about that so I could reach more people. And I have. In the last 2 years, I've reached more people. Mm-hmm. And my children and my whole family agreed. Well, my kids didn't really get to pick. And I know that might someday they will. I hope they'll appreciate what we're doing is for good. But I do realize that I made that choice, and it might come back, and my kids will have a great counselor to work them through it.
And I think this actually brings up an interesting topic in that, you know, when it comes to parenting in the digital age, really a lot of times everybody's an expert, because some of the best insights and strategies are coming from everyday parents who are out there on the front lines, right? You know, it used to be once upon a time, you could go to your parents or your grandparents. They didn't grow up with this. And experts, you know, really, they have to come down from the mountaintop, because it's constantly shifting and changing. Everybody's situation is different. And oftentimes we find, we learn, when we go out to speak at schools or talk to different audiences or chat online, we learn more from the parents than I suspect they do from us.
That's very possible.
Yeah. And so we've talked a little bit about this, but Nancy, too, like she kind of had to take some of these into her own hands. But whose responsibility is it really to make these kinds of – to teach their kids about all these different, I guess, standards? And I mean, where does it come from? I mean, you're trying to do it at the 4-H. You're trying to help parents. But should a lot of it come in school? Should a lot of it be – should it all be at home? Is there a balance?
I want it at school and home.
Right.
Because there's so many parents who aren't up to speed, schools deserve to be up to speed to help. It is a part of life, and our part of education is to help them transition into adulthood someday. And becoming media literate and digitally literate is not a one-day, one-semester process. It is a lifetime process that should start the moment you have that footprint in digital.
And I've heard reference to a knowledge-wisdom gap, where you have, with technology, the adults who maybe have a lot more wisdom, but the youth who actually have the knowledge. And sometimes, without the communication, you're in trouble.
Yeah, and I wholeheartedly agree, right? This isn't a zero-sum game. It has to come from all aspects of society. Lawmakers, teachers, you know, government officials. It has to come from educators, from employers. Of course, it starts at home. But these are conversations that need to be happening at the dinner table, at the classroom, at the boardroom. There needs to be online education, continued education resources. Really, it'd be great to see some support groups out there as well. I haven't even touched on problems like cyberbullying or cyberbaiting and the issues that this presents for families out there. I mean, really, we've got to all come together and pull our weight.
Why do you think it hasn't happened yet? Is it that it's tough to develop these curriculums because everything's changing so much, or is it Or is it just a hesitancy to try to tell people what to do? I mean, what are some of the
MTV,
why do you think it hasn't happened?
MTV has some really fabulous programs to try to combat bullying. I think there are teen programs that are out there. I just don't know if the parents know about them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it does come back to parents, I guess.
Yeah.
That's part of it. And you're also seeing surveys that show that school administrators think they're doing a great job, and yet teachers have had 0 to 3 hours of training in the prior year. So really, there seems to be a fundamental disconnect. I think part of it is that parents don't quite realize the level of commitment that's required when you introduce technology into kids' lives, and some of them are struggling to catch up. I mean, one of our suppositions in the Modern Parents Guidebooks is that people just don't have the time, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you're swamped with work and life, and suddenly social networks and apps, and it all changes, new features every week. And part of it, too, is, again, you know, the system has existed for so long that trying to shake things up. And as we pointed out earlier, sometimes when it comes to social networks, they say their policy is 13 and up. Parents are letting them on younger. You know, at what point do you feel compelled to speak up when the system encourages you to do otherwise?
Yeah.
We talked about, you know, social and emotional development. One thing about cognitive development, I think in the age of social, the kids start getting into social media. We know that as their brains are developing that teenagers often prefer their own solutions to adult solutions. And you can beat them over the head with things about cyberbullying and that sort of thing. But until they, you know, it's hard to involve them in the process. When you do, they're going to really get it a lot more. One parent did something I thought was brilliant. And when her daughter got to the age where she's ready for a Facebook account, the parent set hers up as well, and they set their accounts up together. And so as they were filling in their personal information, the mother laughed and said, "Hey, I'm going to be a fighter pilot," or "I'm a professional boxer," and they would laugh, but it got the child's wheels turning to thinking, wait a second, you can say you're anything online.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to take one more time to remind our listeners that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Fumuller, filling in for Reuben Stern. On this week's Intersection, we're talking about parenting in the digital age. Our guests in the studio today are Jen Reeves, a mother of two who runs the blog Born Just Right, following her experience as a mother. Brad Anderson is a state 4-H youth development specialist and acts as a mentor to young people involved with the organization. Meg Ladd is a program manager for ParentLink, which helps Missouri families by connecting parents with information and resources. Scott Steinberg is joining us by the phone. He's the author of the Modern Parents Guidebook series. And for you and our audience, as a parent, how do you protect your kids from cyberbullying? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. Like you said, Scott, that's one thing we haven't really touched on yet. We could talk about it for a whole other hour show. Mm-hmm. But I guess we'll start with you, Meg. Have you had a lot of calls in this regard and how parents can handle a cyberbully or being a parent of cyberbully?
Sometimes, and I don't know why this is, but the calls that we'll get are from the parents who are more concerned about whatever issue it is than the child. Mm-hmm. So the parent might see a snarky comment on their daughter's wall and it's upsetting them and, you know, they want to vent about it. But the children, I think, like you said, they kind of own what they put out there and they know they have that option to delete or...
Yeah, I think the texting is the part that is a scary. Of all the things,
right.
Texting's the part that scares me as a parent. And I hope that when texting, you know, I have a 10-year-old, and I haven't given him a phone, nor have we started iMessaging or anything like that. He just realized I have a Gmail account for him. So we'll see how that goes. So I think it's teaching very early an appropriate use of texting, and then having open willingness to I've been talking to my husband and I are discussing how maybe we'll create a Google Voice account where when you text through Google Voice everything's archived, and mm-hmm. that may be very tightly watching, and it may be that when is it too much, when is it too little, but I'd rather have open texting in our household than deleted texting.
Mm-hmm. So that paper trail is important, right?
Yeah, I don't know. We'll see how it goes.
I had a workshop with about 20 teenagers a few weeks ago, and I asked them, you know, how many of you either have been or know somebody who has been exposed to something inappropriate or bullying via text messages or social media, and every single person raised their hand. I mean, it's very common. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this whole phenomenon of sexting probably isn't as frequent as the mainstream media might portray it, but things like this are very serious problems.
And I guess, I don't know, maybe Scott, you can help answer this, but when is the right time to intervene as a parent if you see your child possibly being cyberbullied or, you know, through whatever routes, or if they come to you about it? What are some of the ways to, I guess, handle that?
Right. Well, as far as when the appropriate timing is, that differs depending on the situation, right? You have to feel it out and use your best wisdom and judgment. But as far as ways to handle it, certainly you need to be having the conversation with your kid. You need to have an eye towards it as well as how the problem is developing. And ultimately, you may need to get involved and speak with school officials, speak with the parents of the person doing the cyberbullying. You can reach out to the Internet service provider, especially if they're anonymously attempting to attack a child. The trouble is so many times in those scenarios that if you antagonize or attempt to go against the bully, they just continue it and step up their efforts, or they find an alternate venue. And so really, you know, there's support groups that are out there. But there's a number of resources that Common Sense Media and the FBI and other providers provide that can help you. You know, they pointed out that MTV has some great programming. So really what we need to do is let kids know that help is available. But what you can't afford to do is ignore the problem, right? You know, a lot of times, sometimes it will diffuse itself if left alone. But you can't simply write it off. And it's a valid concern. And you have to be aware. You have to understand what's going on. And you have to understand what your kid is being exposed to, because it can have very meaningful impact on them.
One other thing I'd like to talk a little bit about, I've kind of been devil's advocate, right, for a lot of this. What's the problem? What are the concerns? But what are some of the ways that the digital age and these different products, how have they brought – you've talked a little bit about the communities it's brought together, but families as well. How has it got families and communities – how has it worked as a positive in their lives, I guess, this new technological age, I guess?
What I've heard from parents is, like, as they get into the teenage years and they're so busy with other activities, that can be one way of keeping the lines of communication open. And I would just really emphasize open communication and trust. And if you have that in your relationship with your child, all other things can be fixed and addressed.
Yeah, I went down this route. This all started when my brother went to the Peace Corps in the Dominican Republic in 2002. And a few months before my son was born, I was like, you can't not see him. So I started a website so I could have weekly photo updates about his growth and get to know his nephew before he got to meet him in person. And so it has brought my family lives all over the country. And so my family feels as connected as they could be. And then you add in video chats, and my kids have very close relationships, and my family is very tied to what's going on in our lives. And that's why this started in the first place. It kind of snowballed into more positive directions as well. But it all started because our family wanted to be together, even if we can't all be in physical togetherness.
What about just that traditional family unit too, though? What about just in the home having these types of, you know, I guess technologies available? I mean, just in daily interactions, have there been ways that you've been able to connect more with your child, I guess, because of these things you didn't have when you were a kid, I guess?
Well, I know my three-year-old has a little device, so she punches it, some music plays, and she's already referring to that as her iPod. So I have a feeling that we're well on our way. She'll be a social media guru in no time.
Totally.
One other thing we could talk quickly about, Jen, is your South by Southwest panel you recently had.
You were
the expert there, right? Because it was talking about. Oh, I guess tell us a little bit.
Sure,
what it was talking about.
I had a panel, brainstorm panel at South by Southwest. Kate Canterbury, who's here in Columbia, Missouri, and Robert Rummel Hudson, who's written a book called Skylar's Monsters about his daughter's special needs as well. We did a panel talking about how we would love technology to help blend all of these little sections of special needs communities. They're all very siloed based on diagnosis, and how technology could help blend those communities together better. And I've put in a grant with the Knight News News Challenge. The Knight Foundation is running to try to help build a database of resources on a local, county, state, and national level, which this doesn't exist anywhere, across different needs. And we discussed how technology is able to bring so many different worlds together. And it was a really powerful experience to be able to talk about that with the center. It's kind of like the South by Southwest conference is kind of the center of social and technology. It's also the geek spring break. So it's also very social and physical presence as well. But we came out of it with some really big goals. And we are launching a site called specialneedtech.com, where we're going to try to help share stories of technology that's useful across the board. And we're hoping to go nonprofit and start a technology distribution for families that can't afford things like the iPod Touch, the iPad, that really have awesome tools for kids that can use it. It's just that healthcare doesn't pay for consumer grade technology. They pay for the really expensive, like my daughter's super expensive prosthetics. So it's
So it wasn't just getting around talking. It really was. I mean, it sounds like you actually have an action plan and are going for it.
If I can find the finances, yes, it's going to be awesome.
The other plug we'll get in, ParentLink. You guys have an event coming up. Is that right,
Meg? We do. April 21st. It's a Saturday, and it's the Tiger Family Fest. It's from 10:30 to 3, and it's a family-friendly event for Columbia-area families.
Okay.
So we're going to be there.
You're welcome. Perfect.
Well, there you go. Dual plug for you guys.
Yes.
We just have a few minutes left here. One thing, I opened the show by talking about, and I gave this arbitrary number of 5 years, right? What about the next 5 years? What do you guys think lies ahead? And I guess maybe, Scott, you could start with this. What advice do you give for parents in the coming years, I guess?
Well, the advice I give is brace yourself and get ready to get involved now, because at the end of the day, it only steps up the pace, right? There's going to be more technology, more streaming media on demand, more ways to connect, more ways to communicate, more ways to play. Kids are going to get savvier. They're growing up with technology second nature. So what comes next? I mean, I can tell you, I just came back from Toy Fair, the big annual gala. They've got Barbies with digital cameras built into them, action figures with apps. So kids are getting plastic faux cell phones and tablets at 2 to 5. So really, it's time to get involved.
Right. And so how do you guys plan to do that? You've got kids that are going to be coming of age in the next 5 years, right? So what do you guys plan to do, I guess?
I think it's like the Borg. Resistance is futile. You really need to get on board. You need to understand it. It can't be a foreign language to you.
Right. And have fun with it. Like, I really enjoy some of the games that my daughter plays, because she tells me why she likes it, or, you know, what different apps and things that keep her interest. So it helps us have a better conversation about things.
Yeah, my son actually did a Prezi to explain why sports, right after Mizzou lost, he had a hard time with that. And he did a Prezi about sports and how sometimes you win and sometimes you lose. And it was how he expressed himself through technology. And I think that in the next five, he'll be 15. Huh? And so we have a lot of very open lessons to be taught, and we need to find his expressions are very digitally based. I wonder why. And he's good at it, and I want to keep encouraging him to share in a responsible way. So it's going to be a lot of work.
Well, I know we have a lot of people who are resistant to getting into this world because of the privacy concerns, and I think that it's an extremely valuable conversation to have. You need those people who raise those concerns, just as you need those people pushing us forward, because between the balance of the two, we're going to get something that we like. Yeah. So I think try to overcome your fears, but don't give up your principles.
Yeah, and vitally important, I think, is that we have the conversations, that we put the varying viewpoints out there and firsthand experiences. And so please, by all means, blog about it, download the books, talk about it, go on social media, share the articles, let people know, and let your educators know and people in your local community know that we need to be talking about these subjects, because they're not going away.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for today, guys. Thanks a lot for joining us, Jen Reeves, Brad Anderson, and Meg Ladd, and then Scott Steinberg for joining us over the phone. We'd like to remind those of you enjoying this as a rebroadcast that Intersection takes place live for a full hour every 2 to 3 every Monday afternoon. You can watch live streaming video of our program each Monday afternoon online at kbia.org. Alongside that video, you can submit your questions and comments and participate in an online discussion with others in the audience. You'll also find an archive of all our past programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. Intersection is a broadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute and is a project of RJI and KBIA. Intersection is produced by Raymond Tungekar, Janet Saidi, and Leanne Butkovic. Travis McMillan is our technical director with production assistance from Leah Becerra. Pat Akers is our audio producer. Executive directors are Mike Dunn and Mike McKean. I'm Ryan Femuehlner, filling in for Reuben Stern. Thanks for joining us today, and have a great week.